Welcome to the Industrialised podcast, where we speak to those leading the charge towards the future of construction. This week, Darren Richards, Director of Cogent Consulting, speaks to Trudy Sully, Industrialised Construction Director at Mott MacDonald. In this conversation, Trudy talks about the success of product platforms, examines how to bring clients on the industrialised construction journey, and why industrialised construction finds housing so challenging to get right.
Welcome to the Industrialised podcast, where I'm joined today by Trudy Sully from Mott MacDonald. Hi, Trudy.
Good morning.
Please tell us a little bit about your self and what you do at Mott MacDonald.
Okay. So I am a director for industrialised construction at Mott MacDonald. My official title there is actually technical director, but technical is definitely one thing I am not. I do not have any construction qualifications, but I have been working in the industry for about 8 years and getting away with it on that front so far. I suppose a little bit of background, the reason I came to work in construction is because I've had quite a diverse career working with a whole range of different industries, but an awful lot of common ground in terms of supporting change and transformation and looking at challenges and how companies of all sizes can address them, and largely in a collaboration environment. So my journey sort of started there. But yes, at Mott's I work with a team of specialists in industrialised construction, sort of a small unit of about 10 of us. And we're sort of, we're considered a practice, and that is sort of where a group of expertise sits, and we work with the rest of the organisation to help embed DFMA, platform thinking, modern methods of construction, offsite, and of course industrialisation into our programmes and supporting Mott MacDonald and how they fit that sort of mould going forward.
And is that a global role? You get to see the rest of the world and what's going on?
Yeah, a little bit. We have a huge demand for our advice and expertise around the world. Globally, there's actually about 400 Mott MacDonald employees that are sort of signed up to the practice. So those are people that have some experience in this. The core team is based all in England, but we sort of have champions in different regions. But Mott's has got 20,000 people globally, so we're a very large, very diverse organisation, and but with, you know, a vast array of projects that are starting to adopt these approaches. And I sort of see it as a sort of a large microcosm of how the industry is evolving in this area as well.
Yeah, great. That's good. And your route in then to the industry. Let's just talk about some of the great work that was done when you were at the MTC, and then your involvement in the Construction Innovation Hub. Mm-hmm. That's probably within that 8-year period that you were just talking about a few minutes ago. So it'd be interesting to just understand how you got into that, what lessons came out of that, because obviously that was around bringing government and industry and academia together, and just give us a kind of a flavour really for what you think the biggest achievements were in that period.
Yeah, so it was an interesting journey. So I joined MTC, the Manufacturing Technology Centre, which is a catapult centre. So they're partly government-funded centres to support organisations in innovation, fundamentally. So helping to develop concepts from relatively low levels of development into something that's much more viable. When I joined them, I was actually working across industries, and they have a very broad range of activity across a wide range of industries. But what we identified, and actually sort of around the same time as the Pharma report came out, was that construction was an industry that clearly has a huge significance in our economy, and delivers, obviously, all of our built environment, but very much challenged in terms of productivity performance, being able to meet expectations in terms of cost and delivery timescales. So we started looking at where we'd worked with other industries with similar challenges and how that could translate. And the opportunity sort of became very apparent. We started engaging with industry. And so at MTC, I set up a business unit to support the construction sector, and looked at particular applications that we could translate from other industries to support transformation and improvements in construction.
Those those industries would be what? Automotive, aerospace, or?
Yeah, and you know, any manufacturing environment, MTC was already heavily involved in domains such as oil and gas. Rail infrastructure was already sort of quite active there. That was sort of leading the way. But it's we sort of pulled from quite a lot of different environments and looked at commonalities between them and then whether or not that would be relevant to construction as well.
Okay. And the business unit at MTC predates the launch of the Construction Innovation Hub, I presume.
Yeah, that's right. So it was a bit of an exploration, but a very successful one. And that is when we were engaging with government and with Innovate UK and looking at the opportunity to put investment into the industry to help with that transformation. And, you know, when you mentioned automotive and aerospace, they've had very literally billions of pounds of investment from government to support innovation and transformation, whereas the construction industry as a whole had had virtually nothing. So we put forward the proposals. There was the development, the Construction Innovation Hub was supported as part of the sector deal at the time. And then we pulled together a consortium to bid to be able to run that. So we got it. And that was a four-year program, 75 million of investment from government, more than, I think we ended up more than double match funded from industry partners to build up those tools and approaches to actually then be able to assist the industry in adopting them in a more de-risked environment.
And frustratingly, that obviously came to a natural end at the end of the funding programme, and we've been without that for a few years now, unfortunately. So I think one of the challenges for us around the industrialised construction initiative, if you like, is to try and get back into that space and try and get an equivalent of the Construction Innovation Hub back up and running, because I think we miss it.
Indeed, the mythical Hub 2. I think, you know, it's... There have obviously been discussions, there have been proposals, and there we do have significant support, I think, from a large number of areas within government for that funding. But the mechanisms, as we all know, are quite challenging, and everybody wants money from government at the moment. But I do hope that there is the recognition from the successes of the first round of the Construction Innovation Hub and the ongoing need for more support and more enabling environments that we will see more funding come through.
And on those successes, in a sentence, what would you see as the biggest successes that came out of the hub in that period?
So I think the major outputs, that there was a lot more actually delivered than people even realise, and you know, that there is still a significant archive of research and reports and studies that are there for the taking. They're all freely available, but sort of the really major outputs and the ones that are still evolving and are being used in various ways include the product platform rulebook. So that was sort of the guidance to explain, position, and steer people through the development of product platforms. I think, you know, anybody that was involved with it would say it's not perfect, but like many of these things, you need to be able to lay it down and put it out there so that people can then use it and abuse it, and we will be able to iterate it and take things forward. The value toolkit was another very significant piece of work with a huge amount of investment and time from well over 100 organisations to develop it. And that is actually that should come sort of before the product platform rulebook, if you like, because it is about making better decisions fundamentally, looking right up front about what you build, why you're going to build it, how you're going to build it, the relationship. And the mechanisms that might be involved. That took quite some time after the hub to actually be fully out there. So it was another slightly painful journey, unfortunately, but now that is again freely available through Constructing Excellence websites. So anybody, anywhere in the world, actually, and that's what we really liked about these tools, is that they are pertinent in any area around the world, because they are universal truths, if you like.
Yeah, and fully open source, you know, which is the way it should be in terms of, you know, that knowledge acquisition and knowledge sharing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And obviously there are other initiatives, Seismic and various other commercialised initiatives that came out of that. So generally, a pretty successful return on investment, I think you would say the hub was. Hence why I think we're or quite frustrated why Hub 2 hasn't just, you know, come about a little bit earlier. But I think we all know where we are in terms of how tight the cash is at the moment. But yeah, one day I'm sure it will happen. Picking up on the product platform rulebook, and then it's just evolving the conversation towards that then. So I suppose the question really for me is, what extent can product platforms and ultimately DFMA, you know, deliver in terms of design repeatability and flexibility? Because it's a great ethos. I think the logic is very sound, but not everybody gets it. We don't see a lot of day-to-day practical implementation of what the rule book espouses. So what are the challenges then to get people really thinking around product platforms? Because we've seen very few successful large-scale platform rollouts. We've seen one-offs and case studies and, you know, some very interesting successful projects, but it doesn't appear to be permeating and rolling out at the pace that I would have thought it would.
No, absolutely, and I agree. And unfortunately, that sort of cessation of the hub, I think, is a factor there, because that was the sort of the enabling environment to be able to support industry. And of course, it's very difficult to implement change when you're already in a really challenged environment. It might be the absolute primary thing you need to do, but being able to set aside the resource and the time to be able to spend on doing it can be quite challenging. But yeah, product platforms. So the concept of it from the start was really, again, looking at other industries and how greater levels of standardization and commonality enable better productivity and efficiencies in delivering of products. And the key element that I think people can often miss is that they do tend to see words like standardization as bad, and that we're trying to make everything look the same. Whereas actually the fundamental principle of a product platform is that you look at what you standardize, what you bring in to sort of that really disciplined environment, and then how you balance that with variability. And that's where things like the interfaces come into play. So it enables a greater level of adoption of manufacturing processes and standardization of elements that can and should be standardized. But the way that that product platform interfaces with other elements is where you get a level of variability and through to bespoke aspects too. So balancing is really important.
Yes, it's more an invisible standardization ethos really is what we want. You know, all the things behind the scenes that nobody really cares about can all be standardized, repeatable. And that customization element might be a facade or something that is more obvious in a building's design, the character of the building.
Yeah, and the reconfigurability as well. So that's actually another aspect to think of. And I really wish I had the stat embedded in my brain because I can never remember it. But people, when you actually give people, and I know Lego is something we come back to quite often, but Lego is quite a good example of a product platform that is eminently successful, and has risen again. But if you take just a few blocks of Lego, the amount of different ways that those very standard elements can be put together to create different shapes, different angles, different positions is immense. And actually, when you show people that and then you tell them the number of different configurations, it's huge. We reference automotive a lot. There are good ways of doing it, and there are negative connotations too. I always think one of the positive sides is that, you know, cars are built on platforms, and they have very standardized elements. Nearly all cars have four wheels, in one in each corner, and it has to fit on half a road. That's a higher degree of standardization, but that then you need in buildings, is how I meant. But when you look at certain models, there may only be one chassis, but the mass customization options in automotive now means that you can have, well, the Jaguar F-Pace, 10,000 different configurations of all of the variable parts. So the opportunity when you go to a product platform for a building or part of a building could be even greater. And if you look at 10,000 houses that could be all slightly different, then you're definitely not going to have boring, are you?
Definitely not. And I think your point there about, you know, these economies of scale is where the automotive industry has, you know, been successful. You know, you're getting a higher quality product than you've ever got for a more cost-effective maybe a cheaper price, but you know, you're also seeing in that industry phenomenal productivity improvements.
Indeed.
Which we haven't seen in the construction industry for decades. You know, I think we've flatlined, and possibly even in recent times, productivity of the construction sector has even perhaps slightly waned and dropped off a little bit. And you know, whilst I think you're right, you know, automotive, you can mention it too many times almost, and people say, well, but we don't make cars. I think if we can just shift the narrative a little bit, there is a very sound logic to mimic a lot of what the automotive industry does, you know, and platform design is one of those, isn't it, that I think could be a good starting point. You mentioned about culture and transformation work that you do. The logic of, say, something like a product platform, I think, is well understood, and you can convey it quite easily. But that's only the starting point. How do you address changing the psychology and the culture with your clients? Do you do sandpit sessions, workshops? Do you show them real working life case studies? Because how do you bring them on the journey with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's generally people don't believe things until they can see it or you can prove it. And I think that's one of our industry's greatest challenges overall, is that we're actually pretty rubbish at measuring things. Which sort of seems a bit ironic, but has proven out. You know, we when we started at the Construction Innovation Hub, we had massive problems in trying to baseline costs or baseline anything, because we're just, those that do measure don't share, and most don't. That's sort of part of the environment. Every project starts from scratch or thereabouts, and it makes it very difficult to evidence the improvements. That said, the Value of Platforms report, which was one of the final sort of reports put out from the Construction Innovation Hub, demonstrated that across government social infrastructure, the adoption of product platforms could realise £2 billion of capital savings per year on what is standard delivery at the moment.
£2 billion.
£2 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. And a huge boost to GDP as well. So that was a really detailed macroeconomic analysis to bring out those. But it also demonstrated and sort of looked at the qualitative aspects in terms of efficiency, flexibility, diversity of workforce, that there's quite a lot of aspects. But it is still paper-based, and what we need to do is then help people to see it. So that the culture side of things is quite bizarre, because I think that there is a lot more data out there, and I really wish people were more open in sharing where they've made those improvements. And I know, because I judge the Offsite Awards, and several other awards for that matter, and I find it intriguing how some companies have learnt that measuring what they do is, well, it's the way to win awards for sure when I'm judging, because when somebody can actually demonstrate to me the savings they've made and the improvements that they've gained and the benefits that have been realised by the client and the end user, then the project and the company sell themselves. When somebody just writes, we're 100% committed to sustainability, it drives me insane.
Yeah.
And we still see more of that than the other. It is improving. I've got to say, over the last few years, I've seen more organisations starting to really prove what they're doing. And that's a delight to see, but we need to shift it.
Yes, and to get more tangible evidence.
Yes.
And on that basis, obviously, winning somebody over and taking them on the journey, often, if you show them an example of what success looks like, That's you know, typically they kind of come on the journey with you quite quickly, but we don't have a lot of best in class examples, or if we do, the people that are doing it keep that information to themselves. But you have the benefit within MOTS and this enormous organisation of looking globally at best practice. Mm-hmm. So do you often look at other territories, other parts of the world where they're doing it better than we are, to find an example to win the argument, or are you very much still focused only within what's happening in the UK?
I do look globally quite a lot. I've just judged the offsite competition in Australia, and it's quite interesting, you know, in a very different environmental capacity, that a lot of the challenges and a lot of the type of projects and what they're looking to do have a great deal of overlap. I think globally we're ahead in the UK in terms of that investment in looking at these approaches in the future. So what the Construction Innovation Hub did, all of the work that went on around it with government, with academia, with industry, puts us ahead in theory. I think we are still struggling with the practice, you're right, and actually that's where we do need to look at doing things differently. When I've spoken at international conferences, I tell them about the work that we've done. That's why they ask me to be there. But I also tell them it's all available. And you know what? They then go and read it, and they have started using it. And countries like Australia are actually investing significantly in this now. So there is a risk, but I hope it's sort of almost laid down as a challenge, that other parts of the world will overtake us because they are willing to invest, or they have the opportunity, the environment, to be able to put more money behind it and start proving it. So I think we'll get more and more case studies coming from around the world.
Yeah, and they'll catch up. They'll acquire the knowledge that's taken us decades to create, and they'll move on faster. You know, and we're seeing that in Southern Ireland, you know, with some of the initiatives around MMC Ireland, you know, where they're looking for best practice, you know, they're unashamedly acquiring other people's ideas and putting them into practice, and there's nothing wrong with that.
So, I thoroughly encourage it, because I think it is sort of that global competition is almost, you know, fires people up a bit. But they're also more, that they're able to be more dynamic. Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, they've got much smaller populations, they've got governments which are working more closely with the industry, and they can be that little bit more flexible and dynamic in moving it forward. But then that gives us opportunity to learn from them in return.
I mean, I think, you know, if we go back to the context of industrialised construction in the UK, you know, we look at the fantastic work the Ministry of Justice has done, Defence Infrastructure Organisation, MOD, Department for Education around standardisation, you know, framework rollouts, new hospital programme. You know, we're doing some fantastic stuff, really. You know, the rollout of platform thinking and DFMA, you know, across those four or five fairly large government departments is pretty prevalent, isn't it? You know, you can see it, it's there, it's working. We just maybe don't capture and evidence and celebrate some of those successes enough. You know, I think we need to do maybe some more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I've seen and been involved with all of those departments over recent years, and the I think it's a really good example actually of these things don't happen overnight. You know, you can't just flick a switch and move from traditional construction to product platforms and industrialization. It should be iterative, and it takes time, and it takes a lot of continuous improvement. And I think we're really starting to see that with the government departments, and again, I really want them to start shouting about it. So some of the contractors in particular that are working on these projects are at least putting submissions into competitions. And you're right, we're starting to see, I mean, looking at Ministry of Justice with the prisons program, because they are now on iterations. So they have, you know, they've done the first one that was maybe a bit more expensive than intended, but got some really great results. Moving on to new builds, they're learning from their first time round. They're improving, and the results they're generating and measuring are really starting to bear fruit. But what we're not seeing, and which I really like to see, is the government departments shouting about it, releasing some of this really valuable data. And actually, back to things like the construction playbook, the opportunity for cross-department learning and looking at their own levels of commonality, which would then give much more opportunity to industry to invest. Because if you're just looking at prisons, or if you're just looking at schools, or just looking at hospitals, there's still a hell of a lot to do. But if you're a supplier of something relatively specific, the chances are that your products are needed by multiple different build asset types, and cross-departmental harmonisation, as is outlined in the construction playbook, would be a really significant step change.
Couldn't agree more. I think that's one of the big challenges. But there are some cultural elements to that as well, though, aren't there? You know, these departments, you know, are competitive, even though they might say they're not. You know, they're the ones that have got to prove they can deliver, because the next time spending review comes around, they're going to be asking for more money, and the ones that deliver to program deliver more, you know, will be the ones that will probably get more money. So, you know, there's a degree, albeit not recognized, I guess, of competition between these departments to outperform each other. And to a certain extent, that might mean there's less collaboration or less information sharing than perhaps there should be.
I think it's one of the things that we've spoken about in conferences and in forums and in these kind of environments. But the construction playbook was put out there, but it hasn't actually been enforced at all, as far as I've seen. The next iteration is due in the next few months or early next year, hopefully sooner rather than later. And I think there's huge opportunity there to actually give NISTA, in their new guise, a bit more in the way of teeth to actually be able to start demanding. Yes, I'm going to go with demanding. Demanding more adherence to these, what are fundamentally recommendations that nobody is really doing at the moment, and making them requirements.
Yes, strong leadership, you know, with a clear strategy and a clear vision, you know, around, you know, an industrialised construction policy or whatever they are going to develop, you know, NISTA. Yes, you're right. I mean, because, you know, they've got whatever the figure is, 700 plus billion or something over the next decade, you know, so, you know, they've got a pipeline. And if you've got pipeline and you're a strong client, you can pretty well dictate to the industry the way you want them to adopt new techniques, new technology, etc. So I agree with you. I think the NISTA opportunity is huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably generational opportunity here. We haven't mentioned housing in any of this, and I have my own view is that housing in many areas has been being left behind a little bit. You know, we don't talk about industrialising the housing process as much as we do around infrastructure and healthcare and education buildings, etc. So is housing being left behind, do you think, in your view, or is it just not maybe getting the headlines it deserves?
Yeah, I do agree, and for all of the time I've been involved in construction, I really have not got to grips with why housing, which is the simplest asset type that we build, is so complicated to get right and move on. I know there's a whole number of aspects to it, but again, I'm committing to my 2025 commitment to positivity. I think that the time we are in right now, with the announcement of the 39 billion, with that huge focus on social and affordable housing, there's just so much to go at. We can't really, I'm not dismissing it, but we can't worry too much about the private sector side of things. Social housing is critical, and it's not just critical in terms of our housing needs. It's critical in terms of the fact that if we improve housing quality and stock, then it impacts so many other areas. It improves health, it enables better environments for education. And if you take pressure off our health system and our education system and our justice system, then it improves society as a whole. So I do see, you might get passionate about this area. Housing is the central focus that we should have.
And obviously it's one of the big opportunities to really eat into the net zero goals, you know, in terms of really strong, you know, performing energy efficient housing. So you kind of create a line of distinction between what the private sector is doing and the social housing sector is doing. It's very interesting that the work that we do from Cogent's perspective, work with a lot of the major house builders, and six of the top 10 now have invested in industrialized manufacturing processes and are adopting platform design. The weapon of choice for all of those is a timber technology predominantly, but it's very interesting because they're not really shouting about it, but the investments are going in, hundreds of millions of investment going in, and they're quietly chipping away at it, and they're doing it primarily to address the skills crisis. They don't have the people to build the way they've always built, so it's kind of happening quite nicely actually in the background at a reasonable pace. So I wonder whether collaboration between the private house builders under their Section 106 agreements, some of the partnerships they've got with the social housing guys, might see an acceleration, you know, in social housing of some of that technology migrating across.
Yeah, I would love to see that. And I have a slight wry smile on my face because I find it quite funny that the, you know, the big house builders are almost secretly adopting modern methods of construction and going down the industrialisation route, when they were actually really quite resistant. But we're going to take the win on that front, I think.
It should.
And it is a very, very positive thing. And again, like we were saying about earlier, I really want them to start shouting about that.
Yeah.
It's great that they're starting to develop it, that they're investing, that they're doing it slightly under the radar, I think is a good thing too. But there comes a time, and I think that is here, where they really need to start standing up. And the opportunity for, I say you've got to leave, not worry too much about them. I'm talking about not worrying too much about what they do beyond the social and affordable for now, but integrating what they do with the off-site industry in housing so that it's not them and us anymore. It is about best practice or best practice for the project and moving forward more collectively, gathering the data and sharing it. House building has been standardized for hundreds of years. It's still just almost a dirty word, but it is actually a hugely opportune time to be able to deliver faster, better quality.
And I think what's encouraging the private initiatives that are going on almost by stealth, as you say, under the radar, is they are making all of these investments, shifting their businesses at quite a significant pace, but they're not doing it for the headlines. You know, they're doing it because there's a solid business rationale. You know, there is productivity improvements, demonstrable business cases, and they're just getting on with it. You know, and that's really, really encouraging, because over the next 3, 4, 5 years, I think we'll see an emergent housing industry where, you know, possibly 50% of private house building is built using a non-traditional off-site method, albeit predominantly panelized, possibly hybrid with pods, etc. You know, and they're moving at a steady, consistent pace. It's really encouraging.
And it's accelerating. I think that's key, isn't it? I mean, the 1.5 million houses target was mostly laughed at when it was mentioned. It may still well be a stretch, but actually I think what people don't recognise is that when you are looking at increasing levels of industrialisation, you're also looking at opportunity to accelerate. So it might be a slow start, but if we get this right and if we do it relatively soon, I'll mention timing in a second, but we will incrementally increase the output year on year, and therefore those targets don't look so overambitious anymore. But timing is critical. If we do not really start to move, you know, we've had a bit of a year of Labour came in, great, big announcements, fantastic. But this 2025 feels like it's almost been a bit of everybody waiting, and we can't afford to wait much longer. Things are getting worse. We have to start accelerating delivery. We have to get the money flowing, and we have to prove that it can be done within the next few years, because whoever gets into government next time, whether it's the same government or whether it's completely different, if we haven't started to really prove it and really embed it, then we're going to have another pause and another stall, and well, who knows what would happen then.
Yeah, we're back to square one.
Yeah.
So you mentioned about $39 billion of investment in the social housing programme, obviously very welcome. It's only announced 6 or 8 weeks ago. I don't know how that translates into real demand. Mm. So it's a big number, and obviously it's very encouraging for the industry. But strikes me that we need to get a bit more clarity around demand aggregation, pipelines, etc. So what's the challenge there? How do we pick that up if we move it away from, have we got the technology to do it? Let's assume we have.
Yeah.
How do we start to get organisations in the public sector, registered providers, working together collaboratively to aggregate their demand so that we're not doing 50 or 100 houses over here and then no more? You know, we're doing several hundreds or thousands using some of these same platforms and same technologies. What's the mechanism for pulling that together?
Yeah, it is a really vital thing. I mean, the pipeline call has been out there for a long time, hasn't it? And that there is now the government's digital pipeline tool. It goes some way, but I think we need to go quite a bit further in terms of the data that is in there and accessible and how it can be used. In terms of on the housing front, again, the work that's being done under the small sites aggregator, I think, is really important. So there's local authorities. Councils have huge amounts of land and space within towns and cities and villages that isn't doing much of anything at the moment. But small sites like that tend to be a little bit difficult to develop. Like you say, small number of houses that could be fitted on them, not so appealing, not necessarily very affordable. But the small sites aggregator is looking at freeing up space across multiple different lots and enabling a range of suppliers, including local suppliers is a real focus, which is really important, to get sort of grouped lots. So rather than it being one site here now, another site over there later, all independently being addressed, that aggregation I think is really important. And I think that's something that can be scaled. And it seems like combined authorities are now getting on board with that. And I think this is an area that could accelerate really quickly. And it could be a great demonstrator in a very short period of time of how we can accelerate, how we can deliver across multiple sites using ideally product platforms to deliver, reconfigured for the specific geographic or constraints of those individual sites, but delivering across a much broader range more effectively and more affordably.
Yeah. And you know, the true definition of aggregating demand, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
And you know, something that I've not seen before, you know, in my working life that's ever really worked that well. So hopefully it works this time with the aggregator tool. Do you see Homes England needing to play a bigger role in this? I mean, they obviously have industry ambassadors, and you know, the likes of Ed Jessef will go visit lots of factories and go and look at lots of schemes and have the photo opportunity and very good at communicating. Does there need to be more intervention here? Does it need to be somebody that, you know, that's kind of almost pushing rather than just having some kind of encouraging policy that's actually saying, yeah, you will do this, you've got to do it?
I think so. And I think, again, we've got a new chief exec come into Homes England. I hope that she I hope she's getting her feet under the table well, because she's got a lot of work coming up. But the, you know, Ed is fantastic, but one face out there from Homes England is not enough. We need to see more commitment, more drive, more determination, and more support coming from them, and people that really understand what the opportunities are and being the real leaders in helping it to happen. I think that commitment, again, from government gives greater confidence to the industry. And we know working in collaboration, you're going to get better results. So, yes, please step up and step out.
Good call. And interestingly, we have two female chief execs in two major departments now. So I'm sure it's going to happen much better.
Yep.
Without doubt.
Yeah, we're taking over.
So we need, obviously, then to think about the skills and the people and the talent within the industry to be able to deliver on this. So let's assume we create the right dynamic, we have the mechanisms, we have the technology, we still need people. So one of the big issues I think we've got generally across the industry, but off-site and industrialized construction methods are not immune to it, is we've got to attract, you know, the next generation of talent into the industry. And, you know, we've got to make our industry look more appealing, more dynamic, more sexy, whatever it ends up being. Obviously, you do a lot of advocacy, do a lot of public speaking, lots of presentations, conferences, and various other things. Sometimes it can be industry speaking with itself, I feel. I'm guilty as charged as well, doing that. How do we engage people from other industries? Because you've worked cross-industry. You've come from a non-construction background, as it were. So how do we get some of the best talents from those other sectors and some of the, you know, these really dynamic young next generation people into the industry? What have we got to do to kind of change the appeal?
Yeah, and this has been an ongoing challenge, hasn't it? And we know how big a skills crisis we are in. And that is a very much a global issue. And I think, you know, that again, it kind of comes back to that proving it and showing it. We're not good at shouting about how, for one, incredibly diverse this industry is. You know, that there is no background, no academic environment that doesn't then have a role somewhere in construction. And I think that's massively missed opportunity in that respect. We could recruit so many more people out of colleges and out of universities into the industry if we actually showed them how exciting it can be. And it's something I've recently just started looking at. Is I think we need more people that are working in the industry now now to put their hand up and go, I built that. Because that's one of the things I love. When I speak to organisations anywhere in the world, they love to talk about the projects they've done. You know, they love walking around London with colleagues and they go, oh, we did that. And it's brilliant. And, you know, they're so proud of it because there is something actually tangible stood there, hopefully for a very long time, that you have had a part in delivering. And that's really exciting, I think, for anybody. I think we need to do that. We also need to get right from primary school age, we need to move away from all of the stereotypes about construction, because there are still obviously traditional sites and there are still very physical roles and they are very appealing for some people, absolutely should be. But there is a much more diversity and opportunity when we start to introduce industrialization, when we start to look at manufacturing approaches, when we start to look at the digital side of what's coming. AI, I mean, it terrifies me, but it's going to be massive in this industry. We need people with those kind of minds coming through and working with us. And I will just give a shout out to the Building Capability Report that Offsite Alliance did with a number of other organisations, where they explored and they identified 19 new roles that we think are needed within the industry in the future. What I was really disappointed about is when that was promoted on social media, some of the responses were, well, no site manager is going to want to change their role to X. And there were some really derogatory comments. But they all came from people that were looking at what construction is now, not what it needs to be going forward in the future. And I think, you know, we still need traditional roles. Absolutely. That is not going to change. But there's also a huge evolution here of very exciting roles with very diverse skills needs.
Agree. And I think, you know, this whole industrialized construction initiative has a more appealing angle to it, I think. You know, it seems to able to kind of wrap underneath it some of those digital and AI and those very exciting aspects of robotics and automation and mechanization, all those fantastic technological things that hopefully will inspire people to come into the industry. But I think the main point you make there is around celebrating what we achieve. You know, our industry achieves some phenomenal things. Some buildings are designed and engineered that are just incredible. And yet we don't celebrate it outside of the industry very often. It doesn't get acknowledged very often, does it? And it's a shame, really, because I you know, share your passion. I'm as passionate about this industry as you are. People say to me, well, why be in construction? You know, it's not a great industry to be in. I say, yeah, but you don't understand it. If you say that about it, you know, it's fantastic. I work with some of the most inspiring engineers and process engineers, you know, that you look at and you just think, these guys are proper problem solvers. Yeah. They're visionaries, some of them, you know. And I don't know how we go about that, whether that's is that a CITB marketing strategy that needs to be done there, or is it just more, you know, the industry just has to do a bit more celebration for itself? I don't know. What's your view on that?
I think, I mean, it's everybody, isn't it? I know that's a bit of a cop-out, but we all have a responsibility to be more front and centre in shouting about the positives in general rather than the negatives. We do have a tendency to dwell on the challenges rather than really shout about all of the great stuff that's going on. And I think that, you know, we do really need to get right back into education. And I know people are trying to do this, but we need schools to start actually having people that understand that construction is changing. It's not just about what we're doing within the industry. We have to get people outside the industry to understand the change as well, so that it does become an environment that kids aspire to working in, not one that's sort of seen as
default.
The bottom of the list.
Yeah, default. Yeah. Yeah. No. You mentioned about your 2025 positivity commitments. You mentioned it in passing. I don't know if that's a real thing or you know, something you've done for yourself. You know, so it sounds like a New Year's kind of pledge or something to me. But your positivity is not, there's not a lot of it around at the moment, you know, and I think a lot of that's to do with obviously the economic environment and political environment, etc. But I think, you know, we can pull people together, you know, people that are getting engaged in this whole initiative again around industrialized construction. There's positivity around that. Just going back to, you know, how do you stay positive, you know, against the frustrations of all these things we've talked about today? Is it that you just have this unwavering belief, this vision that we can do it, or...
Well, I do. And I think, you know, I sort of, New Year's resolution, I don't think I've ever kept one of those in my life, but it kind of was that, because I felt last year there was so much bad news all the time. And in, you know, in the world at the moment, there's too much bad news. But there are really great things happening, and there are really great people fighting for change. And I just wanted to start talking about it more. So whenever I do any presentation now, I always try and find a new case study of a project that's just done brilliant stuff. It doesn't matter whether it's tiny or whether it's a mega project. Actually sharing those good news stories lifts everybody up. And I think what really keeps me going on that is at the events, the conferences, when I'm out and about, and somebody comes up to me and says, I really didn't know that, or I didn't understand it. Where can I find out more?
Yeah. And I'm like, yes, that's it.
As soon as you've got one person that is either negative, I mean, the best people, if you can find somebody that's really, really anti and get them converted, that's the best. But when I get students writing to me afterwards asking, how do I get into the industry? That's
good.
The winner.
Good, inspiring. Well, I'm suitably positive off the back of your vibe. So thank you very much for your time this morning, Trude. It's been a pleasure to discuss your views on industrialised construction and the kind of wider challenges for the industry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Industrialised Podcast. This podcast was produced by Industrialised Construction Media. The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Industrialised Construction Media. If you enjoyed any of the themes discussed, then the Industrialised Construction Journal is the perfect place to hear more from the experts who are dedicated to the advancement of our construction industry. For more information, head to www.industrialisedconstruction.co.uk.